Welcome to the Free to Choose Media Podcast. Today's podcast is The Tyranny of Control, Volume 2 of the 10-part public television series Free to Choose. Government planning and detailed control of economic activity lessen productive innovation and consumer choice. Good, better, best are replaced by approved or authorized. Economist Milton Friedman visits India, Japan, and the United States to show how established industries or methods seek government protection or subsidization in their attempts to stop or limit product improvements which they don't control. Listen now, and don't forget to subscribe to get updates each week for the Free to Choose Media Podcast.
It's harvest time, and Japanese farmers gather their crops for the rice market in Kyoto. Of course, they'll try to get as much for it as possible. And the buyers will try to buy it as cheaply as possible. That's how markets are supposed to work. That's what Adam Smith, the Scotsman who turned economics into a modern science, observed 200 years ago. He observed something else, too.
In every country, it is always and must be in the interest of the great body of people to buy whatever they want of those who sell it cheapest. The proposition is so very manifest that it seems ridiculous to take any pains to prove it. Nor could it ever have been called in question had not the interested sophistry of merchants and manufacturers confounded the common sense of mankind. Their interest is, in this respect, directly opposite to that of the great body of people.
Adam Smith's flash of genius was to see how prices had emerged in the market, the prices of goods, the wages of labor, the cost of transport, could coordinate the activities of millions of independent people, strangers to one another, without anybody telling them what to do. His key idea was that self-interest could produce an orderly society benefiting everybody. It was as though there were an invisible hand at work.
The invisible hand is a phrase that was introduced by Adam Smith in his great book, The Wealth of Nations, in which he talked about the way in which individuals who intended only to pursue their own interests were led by an invisible hand to promote the public welfare, which was no part of their intention. He was talking about the economic market, about the market in which people buy and sell. And he was pointing out that in order for a butcher or a baker or a candlestick maker to make an income, he had to produce something that somebody wanted to buy. And therefore, in the process of promoting his own interests and looking to his own profit, he ended up serving the interests of his customers.
When Adam Smith published The Wealth of Nations, Britain was still a largely a rural and placid place. But the Industrial Revolution was already getting started, and standards of life were beginning to rise. One obstacle was that trade with other nations was still tightly controlled. Merchants in the home market had persuaded the government of the day to impose heavy duties and taxes on all foreign imports in order to ensure themselves a protected market. One of the results was to turn Britain into a nation of lawbreakers. Smuggling was a national pastime. Brandy, wines, tobacco, anything with a heavy customs duty on it. For years, the revenue men fought a losing battle along the shores and inlets of the British Isles. In 1846, after years of argument and partial success, the followers of Adam Smith finally persuaded the British Parliament to remove all duties on goods imported from abroad. Britain embarked on complete free trade, giving a further push to the rising standard of life. What happened in Britain as a consequence of releasing the tremendous force of self-interest had the unintended effect of benefiting millions of people all over the world. And by 1851, the evidence was proudly on show at the great Crystal Palace exhibition. Free trade enabled Britain to become the workplace of the world. But was it all an accident? I don't think it was. Consider what happened in 1868 on the other side of the world, in Japan. For the preceding 300 years, the Japanese had lived in almost complete isolation. They had discouraged visitors from other nations, especially from the West. The result was that by the standards of the West, Japan was backward. It was a feudal society with lords and serfs, and woe betide anyone who tried to change the order of things. Women were third-class citizens. In 1868, a new generation of rulers decided that the time had come for Japan to make contact with the outside world. And with the arrival of the first foreign traders from the West, things began to change. The Japanese followed the British trading pattern because Britain was a leading nation of the world. So free trade came to Japan. Japan became a magnet for other people's ideas and developments. One of the first traditional industries to feel the effect was weaving. From Europe, the Japanese imported the jacquard method, a way of programming a loom to control the accuracy of the weave and so to standardize output. Workers did well in the new atmosphere, and so did their employers. The adoption of mass production techniques meant that workers were able to move out of the traditional industries and into the new industries, which all added to the trade boom. None of us can help being affected by the intellectual atmosphere that we breathe. In the middle of the 19th century, when Japan ended her self-imposed isolation and entered the modern age, it never occurred to her leaders to follow any other course than that of free enterprise and free markets. That was the intellectual atmosphere of the time, created by Britain's success in applying the principles of Adam Smith. In 1948, when India achieved independence, her leaders had all been trained in Great Britain. They had sat at the feet of Harold Laski and his associates at the London School of Economics, or of their counterparts at Oxford and Cambridge. It never occurred to them to follow any other course than that of central planning and government control. That was the intellectual atmosphere of the time. And the intellectual seed took root. As it grew, it needed to be honored, even worshipped. Every year on the anniversary of Gandhi's birth, people all over India do just that. In homage to the great Mahatma, they sit and spin, using methods handed down through the centuries. But it's more than just a symbol of honoring the past. It typifies the policy that they are actually following. The new government in 1948 decided that India's traditional weaving industry and its workers should be protected from 20th century industrialization. What were the consequences of that policy? This is India today, 30 years after winning independence. And these are scenes in a very typical Indian community, one of thousands. It's called Anakaputar, and it's about 1,000 miles south of the capital, New Delhi. This is not the kind of life the government intended to perpetuate, but it is one result of their policy. By subsidizing the cotton that the villagers spin and the cloth that they weave, they made it difficult for modern industry to develop. This is sizing. It's an essential technique in cloth production where the yarn is smoothed clean. A modern machine could do the same thing in a hundredth of the time.
The result of government planning to modernize industry is that the number of handlooms roughly doubled in the first 30 years after India's independence. Today, in thousands of villages throughout India, the sound of handlooms can be heard from early in the morning to late at night. In this village alone, there are more than 3,000 handlooms in operation.
Since 1948, three generations of villagers have sat at these looms, making cloth with patterns that never vary, using methods that never change.
There's nothing wrong with this activity, provided it survives the test of the market, provided it's the way in which these people can use their abilities and their energies most effectively. After all, in Japan, where the government has not specially encouraged the handloom industry, there remains a very small but very productive handloom segment. The trouble here is that this industry exists only because the government has subsidized and supported it, because it has in effect imposed taxes, direct and indirect, on the rest of the people of India, people who are no better off than these people are, in order to enable this activity to continue. Other industries, both textile industries and industries of a variety of kinds, have been restricted, explicitly kept back, prevented from providing more productive employment in order to make room for this industry. The effect has been to inhibit the development, to prevent the growth, to prevent the dynamic activity that could otherwise develop out of the energies and abilities of the people of India.
This looks like a factory, but it's also home for the people who work here. When they're not sitting at their looms, they eat and sleep in a corner of this hut.
Throughout the world, governments always profess to be forward-looking. In practice, they are always backward-looking, either protecting the industries that exist or making sure that whatever ventures they have decided to undertake are encouraged and developed. This occurs at the expense of the kind of healthy development of new, dynamic, adaptive industries that would surely occur if the market were allowed to operate freely. If it were allowed to separate out the unsuccessful ventures from the successful ones, discouraging the unsuccessful and encouraging the successful.
India has tremendous economic and human potential, every bit as much as Japan had a century ago. The human tragedy is that in India, that potential has been stifled by the straitjacket imposed by an all-wise and paternalistic government. Central planning in practice has condemned India's masses to poverty and misery. We know what has happened in Japan. Free trade set off a process that revolutionized Japan and the lives of its people. Improvements in material well-being went hand in hand with the elimination of the rigid social structure of a century ago. It's no accident. As always, economic freedom promotes human freedom. And in the meantime, what has happened to the Japanese weaving industry? This is how textiles start life in a Japanese weaving shed today. A design for cloth is placed on a drum. As it revolves, it is scanned by an electric eye. Each color, each variation in the pattern and texture is transmitted faithfully to a computer. It's all that the modern loom of Japan requires. This loom, is fitted with electronics that make it one of the most sophisticated of its sort in the world. The fabric it produces is the best silk of its kind. Thanks to the speed and efficiency of these machines, the price of the silk is competitive. The workers are highly skilled and well paid. With the new technology, there's very little a loom like this cannot produce. This piece will become the sash of a traditional bridal gown. These are machine-made products, but by any standards, they are beautiful. They can stand comparison with the very finest work of the hand loom. And it's not merely the end product itself that's remarkable. The sophisticated technology which was developed to make all this possible has been adapted to other processes, part of the self-generating development under free enterprise. And it all stems from an ancient traditional industry, weaving, that imported a new method for controlling its looms when Japan turned to free trade more than a century ago. Yet, believe it or not, many still maintain today that markets cannot be left to operate freely, that they must be controlled by government. This dockside is in Scotland. A British government, a socialist government, decided that its role was to protect the workers here from competition. So down there in Govan shipyards, they're building these vessels for the Polish government. To get the order, the British government is using the money of British taxpayers to subsidize the work. In other words, British people are making these ships in order to sell them at a loss to the Poles. Not only the Poles, but also we in America benefit from this kind of philanthropy. The steel industry in the United States makes a fine product. Other countries do too. And their steel is often cheaper, sometimes because their taxpayers subsidize it. So why shouldn't the American consumer buy steel wherever he can get it cheapest, at home or abroad? The American steel industry works very hard trying to persuade us that it's not in our self-interest to buy in the cheapest market. They urge the government to restrict what they call unfair competition, though of course they recognize that there are dangers in this.
The dilemma of asking our government for assistance in this problem of unfair competition bothers many of us because the sword does cut both ways. But we believe that what we have attempted to do is far different than the kinds of direct government involvement that occur in many of the foreign nations around the world, where the governments provide direct financial assistance in the form of either ownership or loans or subsidies in some fashion or another. What we have attempted to do is simply to get our government to enforce United States laws against unfair competition that have been on the United States books. We draw a clear distinction between that and, for example, the several hundred million dollars that the French government has granted to the French steel companies, or that the British Steel Corporation has received $1.3 billion for capital investment this year. So that while we are uneasy in any way interfacing with our government in what we traditionally believe are the free enterprise prerogatives, yet what we're only asking for is that the government enforce the laws that our Congress has passed. And I'm not sure that that's really any different than asking someone to arrest someone that commits a crime. I don't think we would be accused of being reactionary if we reported somebody who was stealing to the police, if it were in violation of a U.S. law. We think that we're doing exactly the same thing when we bring cases against foreign producers who we believe are violating U.S. laws.
The fallacy with that argument is that it begs the real question. Why should there be laws that in effect prevent you and me from buying in the cheapest market? When anyone complains about unfair competition, consumers beware.
that is really a cry for special privilege, always at the expense of the consumer. What we need in this country is free competition. As consumers buying in an international market, the more unfair the competition, the better. That means lower prices and better quality for us. If foreign governments want to use their taxpayers' money to sell people in the United States goods below cost, why should we complain? Their own taxpayers will complain soon enough, and it will not last for very long. History provides lots of evidence on what happens when government-protected industries compete with industries who have to operate in an open and free market. It's almost always the government-protected industries that come out second best. Ask Sir Freddie Laker, the Englishman who introduced low-cost air traffic across the Atlantic. Who were his chief competitors? They were all government-protected, government-financed, government-regulated airlines. He came out very well, made a mint of money, and you and I have gotten cheaper travel across the Atlantic. Nothing would promote the long-run health of the steel industry, make it into a more efficient, profitable, and productive industry than for the U.S. government to keep its hands off, neither providing special privileges nor imposing special restraints. And what's true for the steel industry is true for every other industry in the country.
These women work in an industry that so far hasn't asked for special protection, the silicon chip industry. Every one of these small squares on this disc is a highly complicated, integrated microcircuit. An American technician examines them for defects. It's highly skilled work, and she's had a lot of training. When she's done her job, the rejects will be separated from the rest, and the good circuits will be packed up and sent halfway round the world to Malaysia. The product of American technological skills returns looking like this. Each microcircuit has been enclosed in ceramic by a Malaysian worker who is highly productive at this sort of work, but the Malaysians are not able to test their products. So back they come here to America to be fed into these machines. American engineers are good at producing sophisticated machines. In an operation that lasts a fraction of a second, these machines can test every circuit, can grade it for quality, and then can sort it into one of six different categories of reliability. The invisible hand in this free market has done wonders for both the American girls and their Malaysian counterparts. And that's not the end yet, because American silicon chips are exported to many countries where foreign workers assemble them. The final product is then returned to our stores so that you and I, the consumers, can benefit from $10 calculators, as well as from a lot of other electronic devices that not long ago simply did not exist. When this hi-fi equipment first came on the market, only the rich could afford it. But even when the international market in labor is seen to work to everyone's advantage, people still put up arguments against it.
The usual argument against complete free trade is that cheap labor from abroad will take jobs away from workers at home. Well, what is cheap? Japanese workers paid in yen, and American workers paid in dollars. How do we compare the yen with the dollars? We need some way of transforming the one into the other. That is where the exchange rate enters in, the price of yen in terms of the dollar. Suppose, at some exchange rate, Japanese goods are in general cheaper than American goods. Then we will be buying much from Japan and selling little to them. But what will the Japanese do with the extra dollars they earn?
They don't want to buy American goods. By assumption, those are all dear. They want to buy Japanese goods, but to buy Japanese goods, they need yen. Calls will come in from all over the world to places like this, offering to buy yen for dollars. But there will be more offers to buy yen than to sell yen. In order to get customers, those offering to buy will have to raise the price. The price of yen in terms of dollars will go up. As you remember, that is what happened in 1977 and 1978. By late 1978, it took 50% more dollars to buy a given amount of yen than it had taken a year earlier. But what happens when the price of the yen in terms of dollars goes up? Japanese labor is no longer so cheap. Japanese goods are no longer so attractive to American consumers. On the other hand, American labor is no longer so dear to Japanese. American goods are more attractive to the Japanese. We will export more to them. We will import less from them. New jobs will be created in export industries to replace any jobs that might have been lost in industries competing with imports. That is how a free market and foreign exchange balances trade around the world when it is permitted to operate. The problem is that more often than not, a free market is not permitted to operate. For reasons that seem to make sense if you don't examine them carefully, governments insist on interfering. But when they do, it's not possible to hide the harmful effects for very long. The main reason why the Japanese yen went up so sharply in price in 1977 and 1978 was because the Japanese government had been trying to prevent the yen from going up in price. In the process, what might have been small disturbances were allowed to accumulate into a major gap in trade. As a result, when market forces finally were permitted to operate, as sooner or later they must be, it took a major change in the yen exchange rate to bring things back into line. Why don't governments learn? Because governments never learn. Only people learn. And the people who learn today may not be the people in charge of economic policy tomorrow. As you contemplate this, you may come to agree with me that what we need are constitutional restraints on the power of government to interfere with free markets in foreign exchange, in foreign trade, in many other aspects of our lives.
Want more episodes like this? Don't forget to subscribe and get updates each week for the Free to Choose Media Podcast.